Session number 7304, reel 10.
Colonel King, reel 10. You were mentioning that you received some troops in the West Yorkshires and that you're in the baggage box. Could you describe the box system?
The box system, yes. You had series of sizes of boxes. There was the brigade box. There were bigger ones than that. I think there was even a divisional box. There was battalion boxes. It was an all-round defence. That was the idea. And because in the desert there, there's nothing to you couldn't have a continuous line at that time because there were no flanks. There was one flank, the sea. But there was no southern flank except miles away, hundreds of miles away. Until you got back to a place like Alamein, when you had this from the sea to the Katara Depression. That's a different matter. That's a small distance. But in the Western Desert, the rest of it, no, it's miles and miles and miles south. You can go hundreds of miles south without any flank. And so if anybody attacked you, all you could do was to go to have this box formation of defence. It was all-round defence. Now, in the case of the Bagouche box, if we take, for example, there, on the north, you had the sea. Then, in from the sea, a little bit, you had anything between 500 yards and 1,000 yards of desert, and then you came to the east-west road. That's the road that runs virtually from Alexandria to Mersa II and beyond. It's the coast road, known as. And then you had, from the coast road southwards, another bit of desert, which was pretty flat, a few bumps in it, and then you got this escarpment, which in places was vertical, with the odd track up it, the route up it.
This is an escarpment of rock.
It was hard rock, yes. A little bit of soft sand blown against the sides in places, but basically solid, ruddy rock. And you had the odd route up it, usually constructed. I don't think that I can recall, especially in the Bagouche box, anyone which was a natural route up it, for a vehicle anyway. You then had the escarpment. And that was the topography of the country from north to south. Now, east to west, well, there was, as I said, east to west was needed defending, of course. And so what you normally did on a brigade box, such as Bagouche, you had a battalion covering from the sea to the escarpment, a battalion on the escarpment.
That would be facing south, presumably.
Facing south. You had a battalion in the rear facing west in case anything came out. And then your headquarters were down below. We were down, our battalion headquarters was down just below the escarpment.
Which direction was the battalion facing?
Our battalion was facing south.
So you were on the escarpment. Flank.
Yeah. But mind you, far as I remember, as well as on us on top of that escarpment, our companies on top, and I think we had two companies on top, yes, two companies on top, one company down below, and battalion quarters. We had... there was another company of another battalion. I think it was the battalion facing west that had a company or a bit of a company on top of the escarpment as well. Because the obvious route for anybody to attack the box would be on top of the escarpment. Because once you got those positions, the people down below, life would be untenable for them. Could you shell them and fire on them? With ease, see.
What sort of positions were there? Prepared positions for you?
Well, very difficult. Let's take the top of the escarpment first, companies there. Because quite frankly, the problem was there, it was rock. Sandstone, rock. And you couldn't dig down. You had to dig up. You had to build up, not dig up. You couldn't dig down, you had to build up. And so your positions, your section positions, like that, were a series of sangers.
What did you make the sangers out of?
Out of the bits of rock that you collected. You managed to dig up from. And that you made sangers. Which meant that, I mean, of course, they could be seen. And one of the main tasks one had to do, spend one's time doing, was to try and get deeper. Try and dig down. In the plain where the town headquarters were, that wasn't bad, because all the area around the companies there and things were down in trenches, which you could dig because it was softish, and the town headquarters was in dugout. It was in a dugout, constructed proper dugout with main battalion headquarters with the CO and the adjutant and everybody else, all undercover with a roof on top.
Just overhead cover as well.
Overhead cover. There, overhead cover. And there was quite a lot of, shall I put it this way, a lot of wood and a lot of corrugated iron and stuff had been put into making those.
To revet it.
Yeah. But on the companies, no, they were right out and things. Except the company headquarters, they were dug in. They were dug in usually to the side of the escarpment, boof, like that.
Now you said there were section positions. Does this mean that you'd have a sanger to contain 7 or 8 men?
No. You had one with probably number 1 and 2 on the Obren gun, and then you had possibly 2 other sangers or something like that, where the riflemen were.
So you'd have 3 riflemen in each? Yeah.
Or 2 riflemen each, because I mean, we never, our section strength, I mean, you're lucky if you had 6 in a section at that time.
What length of front did you have to cover?
Vast. Oh, gosh, it varied, but let's face it, for a company to cover 800 for 1,000 yards was nothing. Nothing.
And had these positions been laid out for you when you arrived?
When we arrived, yes. Initially, when we arrived, they all had been made and dug. But later on, I mean, you're always trying to improve your positions. You're always trying to improve your field of fire. And so slot positions were altered. And one either went further forward or one concentrating one's people a bit more. The main idea was that you tried to get covering fire from one platoon, or sections across the front of other sections, and platoons across the front of other platoons, and so on, had a complete fire plan right across the top, which worked in then with any heavy machine guns you had, which I can't remember whether, yes, we did have one in our position, or 2, we had a section in our position. Up there was provided by the machine gun battalion of the 4th Indian Division. And of course, then you had your DF areas, defensive fire areas, from the gunner's point of view, artillery. And so, intermixed with the companies up on the front, you had your FOOs, your OPs rather, your OPs, not your FOOs, your OPs, which were manned as required, really, as required.
And did you have reserve positions for the infantry?
Yes, down below. They were usually down below. They were reserve positions there to give depth. But really, the point was, they were really reinforcement positions for the people on top of the escarpment, from our point of view, that was. Because the point was, if you lost those positions on top of the escarpment, then, as I told you, you got a complete visual plan, a visual outlook of the whole, not just the battalion position, but quite a lot of the brigade position as a whole, you see. So the most important place to hold is the escarpment areas. And of course, in front of that, you had outposts. There, with arm, at our time, there are armoured, wasn't it, it was a very reconnaissance regiment. You can't call it an armoured car regiment because they weren't in armoured cars, they were in trucks. And there was a Central India Horse, CIH, and they used to patrol down south.
Were they natives?
British, you know, same numbers of British officers, but with, yes, with Indian troops. Very good they were, too.
What sort of system of communications did you have in this box?
Well, mainly blind communications.
And you mentioned artillery. Where were they emplaced?
Well, no, they were within the box. We put it more in the middle. They had tremendous number of plans. You see, they could fire on any one of the battalion fronts at all, whichever way they were facing.
Were they brigade artillery?
Yep. They were division artillery. There was a regiment. We had a regiment with the as part of the brigade group. Yes.
What guns did they have?
25 pounders.
And did they have what sort of positions did they occupy? Did they have overhead cover on their gun pits or anything
no.
like that?
They had camouflage nets and things like that, but they didn't have overhead. But there were a large number of alternative positions to move to in case they were spotted. In case they came under counter battery fire, something they can move to a different position. That was the idea. Large number of alternative positions they moved to.
How was the box supplied?
Well, within the box, you all had these 7 days, or was it 14 days, reserve rations for a start, which were untouchable. You didn't eat them. They were there in case. And then one had the normal supplies coming into the box from the east, from Alexandria, and you had your supply points. The main trouble was you didn't get much water. At that time, I think the average was a gallon a man per day. That's all ration.
Was this for all purposes?
For all purposes. Which wasn't too bad, really. I mean, it sounds very little, but it wasn't too bad. And then later on, one got for a mobile bath unit, so you can have a bath. But on top of that, you got now and again extra allowance of water for washing and things like that. And we were lucky as an Indian division from time to time because the Sikhs and people like that, Indians, they use the most massive amount of water. And one of the things that drops the morale of people like Sikhs particularly who can't wash their hair, things like that, is they don't get water. And so now and again, as an Indian division, one got water, an extra sort of allowance of water, which is great. So one could get half a petrol tin of water to have a bath in.
Why were they so worried about washing?
Well, the Indians? It's a natural thing, you know. They do. The thing they do is they wash their feet and they wash their hands and they... and the Sikhs particularly wash their hair, which they're so terribly proud of, and it's part of their religion, and it must be kept clean and all the rest of it. And they're very clean people, amazingly clean people.
Reverting from to Eritrea, how did they get on them when they were in Eritrea? Because water must have been very short.
No, it wasn't there, you see. It wasn't Eritrea. That's the extraordinary thing about it. You were in the Red Sea Hills, virtually, and the hell all rain in the Red Sea Hills. Now, on the plain, you get rains in the plains, too, which are different times to the Red Sea Hills. The Red Sea Hills is a vast amount of water comes down from the hills into the plains, and so in the wadis, all you've got to do is dig down into a wadi, you've got water. Not really much problem with water in Eritrea. Not that part, anyway. Not the route we took, which was virtually going down through the Red Sea Hills or parallel to them. No problem with water at all. In fact, bloody nuisance at times. We got stuck in wadis, which rarely. I mean, one moment you were dry as a bone, and overnight there was rain in the hills, and there were absolute torrents coming down. I mean. Poor Richard Chamberlain, he got court-martialed for losing a Bren gun, which floated away in its box down. That's another story.
So water was more of a problem at Bagoosh than it had been.
Yeah.
How long were you actually there in this box position?
Oh, dear. Right, the Goose box, I suppose it was about mid-April, just about there, I think it was. And we were there in the box until November. I can't remember the exact date, because it was about November time. Obviously, something was happening, and one was being moved around a bit. And we'd been done some training. We'd been allowed out of the box to do some training. And, of course, we'd had a new CO, too, which was... and he, fortunately, had been a brigade major of an Indian brigade. And he came as CO to us. And he was a splendid, splendid officer. And so we'd done our training. He got the battalion into very, very good condition indeed. The troops and the officers had tremendous faith in him. And although morale was all right beforehand, he raised the morale of the battalion tremendously. He made it extremely efficient.
What was his regiment? Was
he was a Royal Warwick. No, he was a Royal Warwick, but he became more Royal Sussex than the Royal Sussex. He really was an extremely good CO.
You mentioned going south for training. What sort of training did you do?
Mainly a movement. A lot of movement in vehicles in case one had one had to move. Because when one did do a long move in the desert, one had a platoon of RASC or something like that, vehicles. And you embussed and debussed, and a tremendous amount of vehicle discipline required. Namely, you had 100 yards between vehicles and 100 laterally, and forward as well, forward and back. Had 100 yards between vehicles, the control of the columns to make them go left, right, and things like that is important. And of course, you had to have all round defence of your column in case you were suddenly met with enemy tanks or something like that. And so all that was practice, and also the embussing, the debussing, quickly getting into your positions, and also the question of quickly debussing and digging a hole in the ground.
Had you had any previous experience of motorised operations?
Yes, one had. One had done it, it was in the first, in Wavell's campaign, before we went to Eritrea. The battalion had that.
So it was refresher training.
It was a refresher. But there weren't, no, yes, but I mean, it was a different thing, really, this time. A different thing, because there was very, very much more a defence against air. Previously, we had the Italians, few bombers, no ground strafing, no Stukas, nothing like that. Now you had an entirely different kettle of fish. One's got to remember at that time that the Germans had, I think, equality, if not superiority, and they were in a much better position because their airfield was much further forward to give us absolute hell. And they had these Stukas too. And if they saw a column with a target in it, they went for it. And so we rehearsed these moves with the battalion group, with the gunners, anti-tank gunners, anti-aircraft gunners, light aircraft. And you had to get your positioning right, and you had to get your screen right, and really, again, it was a box on the move, company in front, company on either side, with gunners in the middle, companies, light aircraft spread around with the companies all round defence, and your anti-tank where you thought the main threat would be from.
You mentioned light ack. What did that consist of?
Bofors, mounted on a vehicle, on a flat, sort of flat vehicle behind, the Bofors just mounted on.
Was that a quadruple?
No, single. Single Bofors. They had to be very careful of their discipline, because we've a lot of towns had problems with the, because the trouble was to have a go at a Stukas is fine. Let your Bofors go, get cracking, and everybody fired everything. But when you used to get the dawn reconnaissance, when you had last light reconnaissance of an aircraft coming over when you were on the move, looking and seeing the German aircraft, well, sometimes if you're stationary in the desert and you've got your camouflage nets out over your vehicles and so on, you may get away with it. Unless the chap is directly overhead, you may get away. But if a bloody stupid Bofors is going, well, then of course you've had it. And we had examples like that of young gun crews not being in the desert very long, letting fly at anything, at any height, without a hope of really hitting it, and of course giving away the position.
How many of them did you have attached to your battalion?
A troop of light aircraft, a troop of Royal Artillery anti-tank. Is usually it. And the normal column had a battalion, a battery, a field battery, a troop of light attack, and a troop of anti-tank.
How many guns were there in this troop, the light attack?
Oh, God. I'm guessing largely. I think it's four.
What about the anti-tank detachment with you?
They were four. But then, of course, one had his own battalion anti-tank as well. One had one's a battalion anti-tank too. And the difference usually was that we had 2-pounders and the Royal Artillery one had 6-pounders. Later on, anyway, they had 6-pounders.
Where did you actually conduct this exercise in motorised warfare?
Just in the desert. Miles and miles of nothing at all, you see. A few outposts and listening posts out we had out of the front of our companies, and that's all. And in front of that, you may or may not have the CIH, Central Indy Horse, out on the patrol. But miles, nothing. So we were a fair way away then from the Germans. Or the Italians are.
Now, when you were actually in the box, when you went off on this sort of training, what was the daily routine of life?
Well, there was stand two in the mornings, the usual stand two, when everybody stood two at first light. And you stood two just before first light, after it was full daylight. And then you stood down, and then when breakfast came up, towns had their sort of maintenance period, changeover of sections, possibly. Some sections had been on all night, or rather, you had sentries had been on all night, and so you tried to rest them, so you put a reserve section or something like that. And you see, you'd been through, of course. Well, it wasn't sort of just sitting about all day. You had specially prepared exercises and alarms and things like that by day and night.
Just to keep you alert.
Just to keep alert. You always had every platoon, more than that, especially the ones on the escarpments, had ACAC sentries. And they had to be changed after X number of hours, because they were in the sun. They're watching the skies for enemy aircraft.
Did you get attacked by enemy aircraft while you were at Bagush?
Yes, but personally, I don't think we did as such. I think the companies got attacked there. But they used to come out there and just bomb. And they used to mainly going for headquarters. There's not much point in bombing sort of individual section posts out on top of an escarpment.
Did they do any damage, these attacks?
Yes, I can recall them getting a load of ammunition on one which went up in smoke, and I can recall them causing a certain amount of chaos in the sort of supply depot, RIASE supply depot, as I remember. Difficult to know, you know, it's difficult to remember.
Now, you mentioned that you had the Central India Horse in trucks patrolling ahead of the, or around the position. Did you also have infantry patrols going out beyond the...
Well, really on their position, you had outpost positions. Listening posts, really, they were. Listening posts which were kept out by night. And they were listening posts just rarely with a section or three men or whatever it was, something like that, connected by a telephone line, back to platoon headquarters. And they were just listening. They could tell the noise and so on. And, of course, anybody going through your gaps, so to speak, and down your track of the escarpment was notified, possessed by night beforehand. So, I mean, you didn't have the 4th, 11th, 6th deciding to go out on a reconnaissance through your thing there, because if so, the listening person would have reported it, and probably the company could have opened up on its own thing if that had happened. So it's all very carefully controlled.
Was there any sign of enemy activity on the ground at all? Did you have any alarms at night?
Don't think there were. Down south, oh yes, it all depends how close. The fact was, the actual attack to any of our town, the answer is no. But the CIH, the Central India Horse, and other reconnaissance people who'd been way down south and west, of course, had come into contact with similar enemy reconnaissance.
Skirmishes.
I mean, a few shots fired or something like that. They were having a look.
Did the soldier get bored with this routine life in the box?
Yes and no. Yes. There was a certain amount of recreation there, but we managed to get sort of knock out a bit of football, or played basketball, and of course we used to have parties.